Today is Wednesday, October the 2nd. Welcome to the award-winning Personal Computer Show. I'm Hank Key. September storm Helene destroyed whole communities across six states in the southeastern United States. You can make a difference. Help people affected by Hurricane Helene by donating to the American Red Cross. They have launched a massive relief effort to support those affected by the hurricane. You can play a vital role in helping those affected by the hurricane recover and rebuild their lives. Your donation will help deliver essential services and supplies to those in need. Big Tech has been collecting and aggregating your personal data. Do you know how big tech companies and our government are using your personal data? We have been bringing computer news, hardware and software reviews, guest interviews, and news of user group meetings for the past 40-plus years. The Personal Computer Show is a three-time winner of the prestigious National Computer Press Awards. Our only advocacies are consumerism and the First Amendment. I welcome you, the listeners, to provide feedback as to what you want to hear. Address your suggestions to Hank at pcradioshow.org. Our website is pcradioshow.org. We are heard each Wednesday at 6 p.m. Eastern Time on the Progressive Radio Network, PRN.live. That's PRN.live, streaming on the Internet. Podcasts of the program is available on PRN.live on the Internet. You can leave us a message with your questions or comment at hank@pcradioshow.org. Hurricane Helene disrupts tech industry. A tiny town just got slammed by Helene. It could massively disrupt the tech industry. Hurricane Helene dropped more than 2 feet of rain on Spruce Pine, North Carolina. The town is home to one of the world's only sources of high-purity quartz, which is used to manufacture silicon chips and solar panels. A tiny town in North Carolina that's just been devastated by Hurricane Helene could end up severely disrupting the global supply chain for microchips and solar panels. Nestled in the Appalachian Mountains, the community of Spruce Pine, population of 2,194, is known for its hiking, local artists, and as America's sole source of high-purity quartz. Helene dumped more than 2 feet of rain on the town, destroying roads, shops, and cutting power and water. But its reach will likely be felt far beyond the small community. Semiconductors are the brains of every computer chip-enabled device, and solar panels are a key part of the global push to combat climate change. To make both semiconductors and solar panels, companies need crucibles and other equipment that both can withstand extraordinarily high heat and be kept absolutely clean. One material fits the bill. Quartz, pure quartz. Quartz come overwhelmingly from spruce pine. And as far as we know, there's only a few places in the world that have ultra-high quality quartz, according to Ed Conway, author of Material World, the six raw materials that shape modern civilization. Russia and Brazil also supply high quality quartz, he says, but spruce pine has by far and away the largest amount and highest quality. Conway says without super pure quartz for the crucibles, which can be used only a single time, it would be impossible to produce most semiconductors. Purity really does matter, he says. You're talking about a process to create the silicon wafers that later become silicon chips, where one single atom being in the wrong place could derail production. Companies have been pursuing artificial substitutes, but so far those alternatives cannot satisfy the world's demand for this pure quartz. According to an annual report from TechSet, a market research firm, quartz equipment is a $2.12 billion industry and growing. What's unfolding in Spruce Pine isn't just a local emergency. Like many climate disasters, it has economic costs that could ripple around the world. According to the National Weather Service, the massive hurricane caused the North Tow River to flood, devastating the downtown area. The conditions at the mines that produce the quartz remain unclear. May Kirsten Haugen of the Quartz Corporation said operations at our facilities were stopped on September the 26th in preparation of the event, and we have no visibility on when they were restored. A second major supplier, Sibelco, based in Antwerp, Belgium, said its operations has also been disrupted since September the 26th. We are working closely with our local team to safely restart operations as soon as we can and are actively coordinating with local authorities and other partners to manage the situation. Even if the mines are intact, getting quartz out of the region may be a challenge. The main CSX rail line in and out of Spruce Pine runs along the North Tow River and has been heavily damaged. The rail line was the primary shipping point for quartz from the mines. Fallout would depend on how long disruption lasts. Conway says he believes chipmakers have stocks of ultra-pure quartz that would prevent a short-term supply chain disruption from hobbling production, but he adds that if Spruce Pine remains cut off from the rest of the world for long, it could have a major impact. Previous disruptions to superconductor supply chains, from earthquakes to fires, have sent ripple effects across the many industries that rely on chips for their products and operations. A 2008 fire at a quartz refinery at Spruce Pine impacted the market. Likewise, solar expert Johannes Bernreuter, head of Bernreuter Research, says that if a disruption went on for more than a few weeks, it would pose a serious problem for the production of silicon ingots needed in the photovoltaic or PV industry. China is the major producer of solar panels, and it relies heavily on imports of high-quality quartz from Spruce Pine, he says. Lita Sean Roy, the president and CEO of market research firm TechSet, has been tracking the supply chain for semiconductors for two decades. She says it's amazing that the industry hasn't been more concerned about the vulnerability created from relying on this one region of North Carolina for a crucial material. But when it comes to pure quartz, Sean Ray says, I haven't heard of any viable sources yet to replace what's in North Carolina. 23andMe is in trouble. What happens to all that DNA data? Remember that DNA data that you gave 23andMe? The genetic testing company 23andMe went from biotech superstar to the brink of collapse. Its most valuable asset might be its DNA data. What might happen to the genetic information of millions of people? It was an idea that caught on. Pay about $100 for a saliva kit, and weeks later, learn all about your ancestry. The company behind this, 23andMe, was a hit. It was worth billions. Countless people took to social media to share their experience. More than 15 million people spit in a 23andMe tube, and people were holding spit parties. But there was one big business problem. Nobody needed to do a 23andMe test twice. It was one and done, and now 23andMe stock is worth pennies. It has since lost 99.9% of its value from its $6 billion market cap peak. Then there were two other big blows. Last year, the company was hit with a major data breach of customer passwords, and last week, its entire board of directors resigned. Some analysts say 23andMe could go out of business by next year, which raises the question, what's going to happen with the generic data it has from millions of people? Even if the company goes under, that data could change hands. That may surprise some customers. They might believe that the information is more protected than it actually is. Federal health privacy protections like HIPAA does not apply here since 23andMe is outside of the healthcare realm. What the company does depends on what customers agreed to when they sign up for the service. Some states, like California and Florida, do give consumer rights over their genetic data. If customers are really worried, they could ask for their samples to be withdrawn from these databases under those laws. 23andMe is not doing well. Its stock is on the verge of being delisted. It shut down its in-house drug development unit last month, only the latest in several rounds of layoffs. Last week, the entire board of directors quit, save for Ann Wojcicki, a co-founder and the company's CEO, amid this downward spiral. Wojcicki said she'll consider selling 23andMe, which means the DNA of 23andMe 15 million customers would be up for sale. 23andMe trove of genetic data might be its most valuable asset. For about two decades now, since human genome analysis became quick and common, the A's, C's, G's, and T's of DNA have allowed long-lost relatives to connect, reveal family secrets, and help police catch serial killers. Some people's genomes contain clues to what's making them sick, or even occasionally how their disease should be treated. For most of us, though, consumer tests don't have much to offer beyond a snapshot of our ancestors' roots and confirmation of the traits we already know about. 23andMe is floundering in part because it has not managed to prove the value of collecting all that sensitive personal information. And potential buyers may have very different ideas about how to use the company's DNA data to raise the company's bottom line. This should concern anyone who has used the service. When 23andMe was asked what it plans to do with all that genetic data if it goes out of business, a spokesperson wouldn't say, but he did mention a partnership with pharmaceutical giant GlaxoSmithKline, or GSK, which has been analyzing the data to try to find medical breakthroughs. 23andMe says 80% of customers opted into this kind of research when they signed up. The company says the data is anonymous. People now are second-guessing that decision. They might be out of luck. You just can't go to GSK and say, hey, my sample was given to you. I want that taken out. If it was anonymized, right? Well, because they're not going to re-identify it just to pull it out of the database. The 23andMe spokesperson said the company is committed to being transparent and whatever happens to customer data, saying its core value is, quote, behind every data point is a human being. $10 million budget woes triggers more New York public radio layoffs. 11 months after cutting its workforce due to budget shortfalls, New York Public Radio will again lay off staff due to a projected $10 million budget shortfall. At least 8% of staff are expected to be let go, according to CEO LaFontaine Oliver. Oliver detailed the financial difficulties in an email to staff obtained by Hellgate, citing persistent increases in expenses and revenue declines despite previous cost-cutting measures such as staff cuts, a hiring freeze, the elimination of senior executive roles, and a hold on annual salary increases and paid internships. He wrote, our deficit continues to climb, and with our Q4 reconciliation complete and the books closed on fiscal year 24, we are now projecting a deficit for fiscal year 25 that is on course to once again reach more than $10 million by the end of the year. NYPR is the parent company of entity WNYC, classical music station WQXR, and news site Gothamist. An 8% reduction in force for broadcaster would likely affect around 25 positions. Oliver blames economic uncertainty and increased competition, saying for-profit, non-profit, and public media outlets alike are continuing to sustain losses wrought by declines in advertising, shifting audience behavior, disruptions in the tech space, stubbornly high interest rates, and overall uncertainty in the markets. He added, competition for philanthropic support is stiff, not only from our peers in nonprofit news outlets who are accelerating their pursuit of these same dollars in the face of increased challenges. Membership, long the hallmark of the public media model, is being strongly impacted by shifts from legacy media to digital platforms. NYPR is providing a buyout offer to certain employees over the next 2 weeks, with job cuts to come next month. The financial landscape for public radio has been challenging. NPR has experienced a 30% decline in weekly listenership since 2020, and numerous stations nationwide are grappling with financial difficulties in the post-pandemic era. San Francisco KQED laid off 8% of its staff in May, the same month that LA's KPCC announced a buyout plan. Additionally, Boston's WBUR, Santa Monica's KCRW, Chicago Public Radio, WAMU in Washington, D.C., and Cap Radio in Sacramento have also experienced buy-offs and layoffs within the past year. In cable TV subscription service, cord-cutting has been accelerating at a rapid pace. Under the radar, though, radio listening cord-cutting is also happening. Apple Intelligence is billed as AI for the rest of us. What is Apple Intelligence? Apple Intelligence capabilities fall into one of three categories: writing, images, and Siri. Apple Intelligence runs on devices such as the iPhone, iPad, or Mac, and on Apple Silicon-powered servers in the cloud, which Apple calls private cloud compute. It depends on your prompts and questions as to whether Apple Intelligence is processed on device or in the cloud. Is Apple Intelligence using ChatGPT? No. Apple Intelligence is not ChatGPT, nor does it run on OpenAI's well-known service. However, Apple Intelligence does support supplemental third-party AI services, with ChatGPT being the first one announced. ChatGPT access will be integrated into Siri and writing tools on iOS 18, iPadOS 18, and macOS Sequoia, allowing Apple device owners to access it without jumping between tools. What tools will Apple Intelligence have? Apple Intelligence capabilities fall into one of three categories: writing, images, and Siri. Writing tools will be available wherever you write. Apple Intelligence will be able to proofread your text, rewrite different versions, adjusting the tone and wording, and summarize selected text with a tap. Image tools will be able to create original images based on prompts in the new Image Playground app. You'll be able to turn a rough sketch into a related image that complements your notes with the Apple Intelligence-powered Image Wand. You will also be able to generate custom and unique Genmoji with Apple Intelligence straight from your keyboard. Apple says you'll even have the option to pick someone from your photo library and create a Genmoji that looks like them. In the Photos app, you'll be able to make a custom memory movie based on the description you provide. Apple Intelligence will give Siri a giant overhaul. Siri will have a new design, richer language, understanding, and the ability to type to Siri instead of dictating. Siri's voice and response will sound more natural and conversational. Apple Intelligence gives Siri an awareness of personal context and the ability to take action in and across multiple apps, and product knowledge about your device's features and settings. Apple says that Siri will be able to assist you like never before. Generative AI has created waves in the tech sector, prompting companies like Google and Microsoft to catch up to the seemingly overnight success of OpenAI's ChatGPT. More than 100 million generative AI smartphones, or smartphones that run native AI models and use AI to create content, are expected to ship this year, according to Counterpoint Research. A survey from McKinsey & Company illustrates generative AI's broader reach beyond smartphones, saying that one-third of respondents are using the technology regularly in their organizations for business purposes. Apple CEO Tim Cook recently teased that the company has big plans regarding generative AI. "Let me just say that I think there's a huge opportunity for Apple with general AI and AI," he said during an earnings call. A new CNET survey found that a quarter of the American smartphone users don't find AI features helpful. Only 18% of smartphone users cite AI integrations as their motivation to upgrade their devices. Well, mobile AI is the next battleground for smartphones. Click to Cancel subscription law goes live in California. A new bill in California dubbed Click to Cancel has been signed into law. It requires companies to make it as quick and easy to cancel subscriptions as it was to subscribe in the first place. Thanks to the Federal Trade Commission interest, with Adobe being specifically called out on this, the provision may also become federal law. California's law was introduced in response to sketchy practices by many companies around subscription services. Whether it's a streaming video app or an internet package, subscribing may take only a couple of clicks, but unsubscribing can be much more difficult. In the worst of cases, canceling can only be done by phone, which may mean literally hours of being put on hold and or passed around between departments. California's Click to Cancel law, officially known as AB 2863, is designed to fix that. The bill requires companies offering automatic renewals and continuous services to provide consumers a means to cancel the subscription using the same medium they use to sign up. For example, a person who subscribes online has to be given an online click to cancel option. This ensures that consumers can easily exit from services they no longer want without being trapped by confusing processes or hidden fees. The Federal Trade Commission, that's the FTC, last year proposed making this a nationwide requirement. The proposed rule would require businesses to make it at least as easy to cancel a subscription as it was to start it. For example, if you can sign up online, you must be able to cancel on the same website in the same number of steps. The FTC subsequently launched an investigation into Adobe after customers accused the company of shady practices in this area. One issue is the consumers trying out a subscription and then forgetting to cancel. With Adobe, you can only cancel within the first 2 weeks. Otherwise, you are charged a proportional fee. Additionally, Adobe does not issue an annual reminder of your subscriptions, as some companies do. Instead, the account simply auto-renews without notice. California is giving companies plenty of time to adapt. The new law only takes effect in mid-1925. This is the most welcome law that has been enacted. California's new law will force storefronts to disclose that buyers don't actually own their digitally purchased media. California Governor Gavin Newsom has signed a bill into law that won't stop companies from taking away your digitally purchased video games, movies, and TV shows, but it'll at least force them to be a little more transparent about it. The law, AB 2426, will prohibit storefronts from using the words buy, purchase, or any other term which a reasonable person would understand to confer an unrestricted ownership interest in the digital good or alongside an option for time-limited rental. The law won't apply to storefronts which state in plain language that you are actually just licensing the digital content and that license could expire at any time or to products that can be permanently downloaded. The law will go into effect next year and companies who violate the terms could be hit with a false advertising fine. It also applies to ebooks, music, and other forms of digital media. As retailers continue to pivot away from selling physical media, the need for consumer protections on the purchase of digital media has become increasingly more important. California Assembly member and bill author Jackie Irwin said in a statement, "I thank the governor for signing AB 2426, ensuring the false and deceptive advertising from sellers of digital media incorrectly telling consumers they own their purchases becomes a thing of the past." LG Smart TVs have started displaying ads when idle. All the more reason to switch off your TV when you're not actively watching it. LG Smart TVs are starting to display full-screen ads before the conventional screensaver kicks in when entering idle mode. The native screensaver ads started rolling out to LG Smart TVs earlier this month, including OLEDs like the new G4 model, and will appear across the home screen, content store, and LG channels. The feature will advertise both LG's own products, with flat panels HD reporting it saw a muted ad for LG channel streaming service, and those from third parties that may be related to TV or entertainment entirely. In a press release, LG Ad Solutions Technology Chief Dave Rudnick said that the ads were effective in testing and present a valuable opportunity for brands to be front and center on the largest screen in the room. In the past, a screensaver ad might have indicated that viewers had left the room, but today's viewing habits are markedly differently, said Rudnick. Now, 93% of viewers multitask while watching TV, engaging in activities like messaging, shopping, browsing social media, or playing games on their phones. As noted by Flat Panels HD, the current screensaver ads can be switched off by clicking on Additional Settings under the TV Settings menu and disabling the screensaver promotion toggle. It isn't clear which regions or specific smart TV models support the new screensaver ads, but LG has previously said it's bringing more ads generally to the webOS platform running on over 200 million smart TVs globally toward the end of this year. LG TVs are known to be fairly egregious when it comes to advertising. Full audio auto-playing ads have been a feature of LG's App Store for over 3 years. But with LG now planning to bring its webOS platform to more third-party TVs and even its own non-TV hardware within the next 5 years, we may start seeing a whole lot more of them. At least the current screensaver ads can be switched off by clicking on Additional Settings under the TV Settings menu and disabling the screensaver promotion toggle. DirecTV agrees to buy Dish Network and its debt for $1. DirecTV announced an agreement to buy the Dish Satellite TV and Sling TV streaming business from EchoStar for a nominal fee of $1 in what the companies call a debt exchange transaction. DirecTV will take on $9.75 billion of Dish Network debt if the deal is completed. In a related transaction also announced, private equity firm TPG plans to buy AT&T's 70% stake in DirecTV. TPG already owns the other 30% of DirecTV. The pending DirecTV-Dish deal would combine the two major satellite TV companies in the United States, removing a choice for satellite users. But DirecTV claims it will benefit U.S. video consumers by creating a more robust competitive force in a video industry dominated by streaming services owned by large tech companies and programmers. The agreement, which follows years of on-again, off-again merger discussions between the companies, needs regulatory approval and is tentatively planned to close in the fourth quarter of next year. EchoStar will continue to own Dish Network, which is building a 5G wireless network to offer cellular services. EchoStar, which also owns satellite internet provider Hughes, said that selling its Dish TV business will refocus its portfolio on the growing wireless and satellite connectivity markets. EchoStar also said that it is raising $5.1 billion from existing investors to help fund the 5G rollout and other general corporate purposes. Dish's 5G plan were previously boosted by the 2020 T-Mobile Sprint merger, in which regulatory authorities required T-Mobile and Sprint to sell assets to Dish. The announcements accelerate EchoStar's mission of deploying a nationwide facilities-based wireless service to compete with dominant incumbent wireless carriers and its ability to further leverage its satellite assets and experience, including developing innovative direct-to-device solutions. EchoStar said U.S. consumers will benefit from EchoStar's ability to focus more clearly on enhancing and further deploying its nationwide 5G open RAN wireless network, which will provide more choices and better service to consumers under the Boost Mobile brand while driving innovation at a faster pace. presenting the IT Pro Series with Benjamin Rockwell.
This is Benjamin Rockwell, and now it's time to get down to business. This is where we talk about computers, the workplace, and, oh yes, a lot of information technology. Andy reached out to me, and Andy had a question in regards to, well, here we go. He's a junior in an IT program at a major university, and he wanted to get some idea of what advice I would have for a student to stand out in the field. And it was kind of hard for me to answer from a student perspective because it's been a long time for me. But I did want to approach a number of different things for him. And I wanted to give him an idea of things that will help him get ahead in the IT field and actually in business overall. So a lot of what I'm going to give you here is what I gave to him. But it applies everywhere. It applies to everybody. So everything that I give you here is just a moment in time, the things that came to me. And to truly stand out in any field is going to mean so much and so many different ways to so many different professionals, whether they're IT or business or whatever else. So, for starters, the basic steps to standing out include knowing how to troubleshoot anything, and that's whether it's software or hardware, different programs, to go in as a novice and still figure it out. Next up, willing to admit you don't know everything. And this is a big struggle for a lot of IT folks who They don't always have the grounding that they should. And I'll give you an idea of how to get that grounding. And you may have heard this before, but I'll give it again in just a moment. But also, lastly, in these basic steps was learning to communicate high-tech items to people in simple, accessible terms without sounding condescending. And that last one is the hardest one for most nerds and geeks. So the first direction that I went in after that was to come to grips with the idea of doing whatever you have to. And this comes from my past. I had a boss come to me once, and he opened up. He goes, "I hate to ask this of you, as it's really beneath your level of experience." And my response to him was a lighthearted, "For what you pay me, if you want me to clean the restroom, I'll do it." It wasn't actually anywhere near that bad, but to stand out, everyone needs to embrace that same work ethic everywhere. Now, in Andy's case, he had success in the tech world. He had experience with his family property management business and with learning how to program, but I had an item that would build experience and character fast. And this is what I think every youth should do. Take a side job at a fast-paced restaurant, one that's always packed. And in his area, he had a few different options, In-N-Out and Whataburger were a couple of those options. I'm looking for some place that is not local, but it has just a ton of customers. Now, I told him, this isn't a career decision. It's a learning experience that sets you apart. The more you have to hustle during the job, the more rapidly you will learn key principles that will last throughout life. I told him, don't make friends there, but rather, you're there to build a work ethic. You're going to deal with jerks, idiots, people who stress over the stupidest things. And smells you don't ever want to experience again. But in the end, you'll come away from that later in life knowing that you handled it absolutely well. It sets a grounding that everybody should have somewhere along the way. continue to push the envelope of learning technology. Do everything you can to continue that passion. He had a number of different things that I looked at on his website. I told him, learn about the LAMP stack. And this is a particular set of programming or that you can install on a Linux server to set up web servers, and then WordPress, but also a new programming language, different hardware, and above all, to learn Google Foo. What is Google Foo? It's like Kung Fu, but it's with Google. Learn how to embrace everything that you need to leverage Google to your utmost ability. And then continue to write down new quests as they come to mind and chase down whatever in technology that is business-oriented and strikes your passion. Last up, I told him to do exactly what he did here and reach out to more people and ask them the same thing. I also gave him a book to read. Read at least one business book for every 3 non-business books. And then I gave him a reference to a book called The Goal, and it's by Eliyahu Goldratt, and it's a fascinating book about how businesses work and how to figure out all of the numbers that you have to make that business just run better. Because you know what? Even if you're not doing it, your boss is doing it, and they need to do it better. And it's a great learning experience. And there are so many other books out there that I could have recommended to him. But the best thing I think overall for him to learn, and for everybody, learn how to be humble, how to embrace doing whatever it is you have to. Instead of being a stick in the mud, being a pompous jerk, or simply stagnating. This is Benjamin Rockwell. Back to you, Hank.
Thank you, Benjamin. Companies are rapidly laying off Gen Z employees. Many companies have laid off Gen Z workers just months after hiring them, and several business owners said they are hesitating to bring on recent college graduates due to concerns about their work ethic, communication skills, and readiness to do the job, according to a new survey. 6 in 10 employers said they have already let go recent college graduates this year, while 1 in 7 said they are inclined to refrain from hiring new graduates next year, according to a survey conducted by Intelligent.com. Close to 1,000 business leaders participated in the Intelligent.com survey. Some employers said they are deterred from hiring Gen Z to work at their companies due to lack of communication skills and poor professionalism. Many recent college graduates may struggle with entering the workforce for the first time, as there can be a huge contrast from what they are used to throughout their education journey. Business owners were wary of hiring those born around the turn of the century because they were often unprepared for a less structured environment, workplace cultural dynamics, and the expectation of autonomous work. Although they may have some theoretical knowledge from college, they often lacked the practical, real-world experience and soft skills required to succeed in the work environment. Unlike their older counterparts, Gen Z suffers from the public perception that they are chronically limited by short attention spans, a habit of laziness, and insistent on a robust work-life balance, a byproduct of growing up in the digital world. Younger workers are also seen as more likely to be triggered and galvanized by social media-driven political and social campaigns that could disrupt the workflow and create headaches for their bosses, particularly in light of the national turmoil witnessed in recent years. Employees born after the turn of the millennium are perceived to be higher maintenance than their older counterparts, according to the survey. In the survey, 75% of companies reported that some or all of their recent college graduates were unsatisfactory. Half of employers said Gen Z workers were most likely to display a lack of motivation, while 39% said they lack communication skills, the survey found. Nearly half, 46%, said Gen Z workers showed a lack of professionalism on the job. Business owners said Gen Z employees tend to lack soft skills that are critical in the workplace. Some experts place the blame on the education system for not preparing students for real-world work. Education today emphasizes theory over practice. Sure, learning Greek mythology is fascinating, but unless you're teaching it, how does that prepare you to communicate effectively in a corporate meeting or demonstrate professionalism? It doesn't. Others said these generalizations about Gen Zers are misplaced. Most of these stereotypes are ingrained in culture about each generation, and the short stick torch is passed every 20 years. Gen Z workers are more likely to display a lack of professionalism and laziness on the job. Millennials, those born in the early 1980s and who came of age just before the advent of smartphones, were considered problem children not long ago. Now Americans have turned their collective judgment into the next target. Instead of fixating on prospective employees' date of birth, business executives should dig deeper. In reality, what makes a great worker is not their generation, but a series of other values and beliefs that we derive from our long life experiences. Some business leaders told the Post that the stereotyping of Gen Z workers is out of place. They were not at all put off by the perception that Gen Zs were too demanding. If anything, their desire for flexibility and purpose makes them more engaged and driven. They don't just want a job, they want to make an impact, and that's a huge advantage for any business. Earth will have a temporary mini-moon for 2 months. Earth's closest celestial body will be joined by a new neighbor, a second moon. From September the 29th until November the 25th, astronomers calculate that 2024 PT5, which is what scientists think is an asteroid, but have been dubbed a mini-moon, will be looping around the Earth. It will eventually break free of the planet's gravitational orbit. At just about 10 meters, the mini-moon will be extremely hard to see from Earth, but its presence will be there nonetheless for almost 2 months. The asteroid, which was discovered on August the 7th by NASA, originated from the Arjuna asteroid belt, where it will likely return once it leaves Earth's orbit. Earth can regularly capture asteroids from near-Earth objects, and that's the acronym NEO, and pull them into orbit, making them mini-moons. Researchers Carlos de la Fuente Marcos and Rao de la Fuente Marcos wrote in their published research. According to NASA, a near-Earth object is any body, asteroid or otherwise, that is nudged by the gravitational attraction of nearby planets that pushes them to Earth's neighborhood. NASA has their own program that works to track locations and orbits of tens of thousands, 28,000 asteroids, with data pages for every NEO, including their orbital parameters and a close approach summaries. Paul Chotas, director of the Center for Near-Earth Object Studies at NASA's Jet Propulsion Laboratory, said 2024 PT5 is possibly a piece of ejecta from an impact on the moon, meaning the mini-moon may have originated as a piece of the original moon, according to the New York Times. Mini-moons can come in multiple types, according to research. The first, temporary captured orbiters in which bodies perform one or more revolutions around the Earth and can remain in the planet's orbit for many months or even years. The second, which includes the upcoming mini-moon, are dubbed temporary captured flybys, as they do not complete one revolution and remain in Earth's orbit for a very short period of time. Presenting Technology Chatter with Benjamin Rockwell and Marty Winston.
Marty Winston has been talking about a microphone now for the past few weeks. We're week four now. This is the last week on the Audio Technica.
No more mics after now. No.
BP40.
No.
So What area does this fit into? We've talked about when do people utilize different microphones for what reasons and so forth,
and that they all have their own attributes and personality.
Yes, definitely. What do you think this has the best personality for?
Well, let's do a little bit of profiling here.
Sure.
We have some compression artifacts. I think everybody's heard them by now.
Yeah.
Maybe only experienced ears perceive it most of the time. If you're doing a podcast, it may never matter. You may never have any listeners. We don't know.
Whoa. We hope you do.
Now, for all these segments, yes, we hope you have millions. For all these segments about this mic, it is the mic I've been using on the air. And I'll do some demos during this segment to let you hear some of the things I'm talking about. You're hearing it in action. What do you think? Is it the mic that makes you sound the way you want to sound? Is it the mic that makes me sound the way you want to hear me? Do I sound the same as always or a little different? Do I sound more like an announcer and less like a person just talking to Ben and to you? Do I sound loose and natural or tightened down or even constrained? Every model of mic has its own personality. And the question to consider is whether that's the personality you want to convey.
Mm-hmm.
Where do you see it useful, Ben?
For different people are going to have different vocal characteristics, which are going to really affect on which microphone you choose. When I went to choose my broadcast microphone, I went through probably about a half dozen of them. My producer back 16 years ago, he said, no, just use mine. And I'm like, no, I like mine better than I like yours. So different people are going to have different experiences with the microphones. And some of this comes from how you work with the microphone. I would say if somebody has a particularly nasally voice, this actually might help bring down some of that nasal quality. If you're it has kind of a little suppression there. I like the low end. The highs are a little bit muted, but that's not necessarily bad. At least that's what I'm hearing here.
No, I would put it this way. If you get this mic for something like a podcast or a radio broadcast or news,
mm-hmm, yeah,
and you want to sound a little more authoritarian, a little bit more like the anchors of old, mm-hmm, this might give you that kind of delivery.
Mm-hmm.
We're at Cape Kennedy now. Where's the launch?
I will tell you that some of the things that are in there are going to also vary. We never actually adjusted the EQ for this microphone compared to your previous one. We have an EQ setup for each of the different folks on the show.
And that stands for equalization, which has to do with which frequencies get accented and which get diminished a bit.
Yeah.
It's shaping.
Yeah.
What is it that you don't like about your voice on the mic you're using now that you want to change? What is it about the direction you're hearing in this mic that is a better or worse fit for where you want to go? That's kind of the process we use every time we evaluate mics, isn't it?
Yes, definitely. And everybody should be prepared to go through a number of different microphones. You can go down to a lot of places. I'm going to name off the big name. The Guitar Center is mm-hmm. you can
or
go
Sam
on
Sam Ash, you know?
Yeah. I know. You can walk into many of these different places and they will allow you to try out microphones off in a room and you listen to them. Take along a good set of headphones. Make sure you've got an idea of what you want. Don't
and also make sure you take headphones that are yours so you know what they sound like.
Yes, exactly. Yeah. And you shouldn't walk in with a $20 pair of headphones or even a $100 pair of headphones. You've got to be comfortable with what you're hearing before you can be comfortable with what you're putting out, what you're saying.
And also be aware you this mic is $350 to $400, depending on where and when you buy it.
Yeah.
You may want to get a rubber bandy kind of shock mount for it.
Yeah.
Audio Technica makes one for this mic. There are others out there. Everything is a decision, and everything is a decision on value.
Is
your voice really so bad that you don't want to sound like you're talking on a telephone all the time? Maybe. But is it so good that this mic is such a perfect fit for, you know? All of a sudden, you know, you'll win the lottery and every beautiful woman will want to make you tamales or something.
Tamales. Okay.
I think we've done a pretty good 360 on the subject of microphones at large. I did not come on here to assassinate this mic. I truly wanted it to be the best mic I ever heard. And it's not a good fit for me. And that's not to say it's a bad mic. It's just not a fit for me. And that's the kind of decision making that goes behind this.
Yeah, definitely. And you have to try them out. You have to, you can't just point at a microphone and say, I want that. And it's going to make everything magical. Doesn't always work that way. As for now, this is Benjamin Rockwell. That's Marty Winston. Back to you, Hank.
Thank you, Benjamin. And thank you, Marty. Public service announcements. Computer Club meetings in the New York, New Jersey, and Connecticut tri-state region. Log on to the club website for more information on remote meeting ID. The Amateur Computer Group of New Jersey meets Friday, October the 4th, 2024. Meeting time is 8 p.m. Online virtual meeting via Jitsi. Website is acgnj.org. The King's Bite Computer Club meets Tuesday, October the 8th, 2024. Meeting time is 7 p.m. at the Park Plaza Restaurant, located at 220 Cadman Plaza West in Brooklyn. For more information, the phone number is 347-278-7320. New York Amateur Computer Club has a meeting Thursday, October the 10th. Meeting time is 7 p.m. Online virtual meeting via Zoom. Website is nyacc.org. The Long Island Macintosh Users Group meets Friday, October the 11th, 2024. Meeting time is 7 p.m. Online virtual meeting via Zoom, and their website is limac.org. The Brookdale Computer Users Group meets Thursday, October the 24th, meeting time 6:45 p.m., online virtual meeting, website is bcug.com. TED Ed Connect meets Tuesday, November the 5th. Meeting time is 7 p.m., Zoom only. The library is unavailable for Election Day. Online virtual meeting via Zoom, website is wpcug.org. Our website is pcradioshow.org. We are heard each Wednesday at 6 p.m. Eastern Time on PRN, live streaming on the Internet. Podcast of the program is available on prn.live on the Internet. If you have any questions for us, just send us an email addressed to hank@pcradioshow.org. In the meantime, stay in touch and remember to do regular backups. I'm Hank Key, and on behalf of Michael Horowitz, Benjamin Rockwell, and Marty Winston, we thank you for listening. Stay safe and healthy until we meet again, same time, same station next week.